You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.
Let's talk. Talk.
John Brown. Elizabeth Boleyn, the life of the Queen Mother. Elizabeth Boleyn has been overlooked for centuries. She's remembered only as a wife on and mother, despite her illustrious court career. You might just think she's only, you know, the mother of those pesky Boleyn girls, but a new biography by Sophie Backus-Walkerman called Elizabeth Boleyn, The Life of the Queen's Mother, has put this to order. And I say that Sophie joins me live on the line now. So good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
No problem whatsoever. Just give me a little bit of background about yourself and why you are so eminently qualified to write about the mother of the Boleyn girls, if you like.
Of course. So I am a Tudor historian, and until very recently, I worked at St. John's College in Oxford, photographing rare books and early printed manuscripts from the library's special collections. So I spend my life surrounded by old documents and immersed in history. It really is just wonderful work.
I'm going to say it sounds like my absolute dream job. The Tudors. Can we have a think about the Tudors again? Because a lot of us may have come to sort of the Boleyn girls due to various TV series and whatever. And though we all like a good drama and lots of roughs going left, right, and centre and ripping bodices. Sort of real life history can be an awful lot more entertaining than that as well. So where does your interest in, you know, in the Boleyn girls' mum, terrible language to use, I know, but where does that start from?
No, it starts from the fact that she is considered a very shadowy figure in English history. So obviously, as you said, you know, Anne Boleyn is such a famous, fascinating individual with so many media portrayals on TV and movies, so many books. A year doesn't go by without a biography of Anne Boleyn or a TV adaptation or something. But where is her mother in those stories? Completely overlooked. I can name maybe 4 TV adaptations and films that have included Elizabeth Boleyn. When we talk about Anne Boleyn, we miss her mother out of the story completely. And so the research for this book began from a place of who was the woman who raised such a fascinating historical figure and how can we put Anne's mother back into the story of history. Where has she been? Who was she? Is there more to know? And so that was the purpose of this book, was to center an overlooked woman in history who has been massively left out of this very famous story of Anne Boleyn's rise and dramatic downfall.
Here's the thing, and I just now blow me out of the water like you would do the Golden Hide on a bad Monday. But here's the thing, right? Mm-hmm. We think of history as we are taught as school children in the wrong way, because we go, okay, so therefore it is medieval period, it's Plantagenets, and then, you know, House of Lancaster, and then crack, you know, like an axe coming down on your head, we're suddenly into the Tudors, and then crack, we're into the Stuarts, and we don't have that continuous timeline, and We don't go back to the anarchy, but that period between the Wars of the Roses and everything else is an extremely difficult and dangerous. And that, you know, the crossover between the Wars of the Roses and the Tudors, nobody suddenly goes, okay, you know, we're going to leave the late medieval. We're going to enter the late medieval period. Everybody get a rough and off we go. So her story must be fascinating because she's involved with and it makes Game of Thrones look like play school, for goodness sake.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, Game of Thrones was inspired by the Wars of the Roses and the real history. And Elizabeth Boleyn is such a fascinating figure because, as you say, she is right at the intersection of this incredible period in English history. Her family, her father was Thomas Howard, the second Duke of Norfolk, and he was involved in the Battle of Bosworth, which is the battle, obviously, very famous. Richard III dies in battle. Thomas Howard, Elizabeth's father, was fighting on the side of Richard III. And so when Henry Tudor wins the Battle of Bosworth and becomes the new king, suddenly the Howards are in trouble and Elizabeth's father is arrested. So she spends her childhood without her father and she's raised by her mother. And that in itself is a fascinating story that we've overlooked of Elizabeth Boleyn's life even before Anne Boleyn comes on the scene. And you've got the rise of the Tudors and this in itself amazing story of Anne Boleyn's incredible rise to queenship and the overthrow of Catherine of Aragon, the divorce of Catherine of Aragon and Henry VIII that leads to Anne's queenship. Her mother is right central in that story. And so I really wanted with this biography to put her back at the centre of this story of events that she was involved in, right at this fascinating period in English history where everything changes. And I think that no more is that obvious than in the story of the Boleyns, this family who are a noble family, who are plucked from as obscure as we would think, but from relative obscurity, and then Anne Boleyn to become the Queen of England, this most unlikely and incredible story, which is why we keep retelling it. I think it's why we find that story so fascinating.
And also what we have to do here, I'm not going to drop the W word or anybody's going to be spluttering into their Lady Bird Book of British Kingship, but the thing is that we overlook the women, the role that women played from... I'm going back to Eleanor Aquitaine because I can. And then we go to, and you've mentioned Carath in Africa, and let's not even get sort of started with, you know, what's happening with the Medici and the Borgias a little bit later on. But the women are the central, if you'd like, unseen building blocks and foundation, because the men are always doing something stupid. They're always having uprising. They're always falling out of favour with the court, and then they're always going to battle against somebody and getting their heads lopped off or getting thrown away or going off. You see what I'm saying here? Getting involved in wars, dying of dysentery, you know, the normal stuff. But the women, thank goodness, are the people who are continuing to keep the foundations going. They are whispering in their husband's ear. They are the real powers behind the throne. And because they are, because you don't want to be, you know, in a Tudor court, any court, you don't want to be the flamboyant one waving around, because if things go wrong, they go badly wrong. So it is perhaps the quiet power behind the throne. Sophie?
I completely agree. I think that the way that certain aspects of Tudor history has been done has been very male-focused. You know, what was Henry VIII's tax policy? You know, what was going on with Perkin Warbeck and who was he and Richard III? And fascinating, of course, these giants of history and the male-centered stories are very important and we do need to tell them. But just as important, as you say, is the power behind the throne and the women and how they use their power and their influence in ways that you might not necessarily see reflected in the kind of documents that have survived. Because who was keeping the records? Who was writing things down? Often it was men. And so as a result, in order to find women, in order to find a woman like Elizabeth Boleyn, you need to look between the lines or see what survives in records to try and find a figure as elusive as someone like Elizabeth Boleyn at the centre of the Tudor court, there much more regularly than we have allowed. When we think about Anne Boleyn's story, how do you find her? How do you put her back in the story? And I think that there is a real wave of scholarship at the moment that asks the questions that we haven't asked before. Who are the women behind the throne? Where is the power really centered? How can we do history in a different way to try and recover the marginalized voices of figures that we have left out in the stories that we tell?
So if you're going to build a power base, you need a base. And as you said before, the problem is that her husband's been on the leading side. He's scarped. Has he gone north? Has he gone to France? Has he gone to Scotland? Where does he end up going?
So this was Elizabeth's father. Yeah. So he is arrested and placed in the Tower of London, and he is there for several years. He's arrested in 1485, and he isn't taken out of the Tower of London until 1489, at which point Henry VII, new king, who is a stranger in these parts, he was Welsh, but he's now in England, he's the king, and he places Thomas Howard in Sheriff Hutton Castle, which is in Yorkshire. It's still there, but it's in ruins. And he puts him there as the Lieutenant of the North, which means that Thomas Howard is in charge of running the North, which is, or was, a stronghold of Richard III. They think of Richard III very fondly in those parts. And so it must have been a very difficult and unusual position for Thomas Howard to be in. This is Elizabeth's father. We know that Elizabeth goes north with her father. We have records that show that she was in the household of her mother in Sheriff Hutton Castle, and this is where she spent her childhood, her teenage years. So she isn't in London at the centre of all of the bustle of activity. She's up in Yorkshire for most of her childhood and teenage years. And that is a fascinating start to her life that I was able to uncover for the beginning of the book, even before she marries Thomas Boleyn and becomes a member of the Boleyn family.
So how does she, because again, you know, with respect, women don't have agency, you know, they have to be married well, you know, it's not, if it's a true love match, great, but obviously marriage is, even, you know, we think of court marriage, you know, alliances between great powers, but even in the great powers of the North is still a thing, obviously, these power bases are still a thing, Wales is still a thing, etc. So How does Elizabeth become a Boleyn? Is that arranged? Is it a love? Does it turn into a love match? What is the 101 on this one, Sophie?
I think that it's very hard to tell. We don't have a lot of surviving sources that tell us about the interiority of Thomas and Elizabeth's marriage, but the Howard family and the Boleyn family knew each other for 20 years before Thomas and Elizabeth married. So it probably was an alliance, as you say, is often the way for this period, an alliance arranged by their parents. And it's often thought of in popular history that Anne Boleyn's story was a story of rags to riches, that her family really came from nothing, but that is absolutely not true. The Boleyns were up and coming. They had a lot of property. They had a lot of wealth that had been accrued over several generations and had made several good marriages for several generations leading up to the marriage between Elizabeth Howard, later Elizabeth Boleyn, and Thomas Boleyn, obviously later to become Anne's parents. So it seems to have been a love match because we know that they had five children, at least five children, three of whom survived to adulthood, obviously being Mary Boleyn, the famous other Boleyn girl of the Philippa Gregory book, Anne Boleyn, and then their brother George. They also had two other children, Henry and Thomas, who seem to have died in infancy. The only way that we know those children survive is by, lived at all, is by two surviving gravestones, one in Penshurst Place and one in Hever, that give the names of those children. It's possible that they had other children, but if so, then no record of them survives. So they probably were close. And they both had court careers. Thomas Boleyn served in the household of Henry VIII, and Elizabeth Boleyn served in the household of Catherine of Aragon. And so by the nature of having a mirrored court career with a husband serving the king and a wife serving the queen, they would have had a professional working relationship as we would understand it today, attending jousts, going to ambassadorial meetings, making sure that the king and queen are attended to during their day, much like ladies in waiting today, as we would think about it today. That was their job. And so they were career courtiers together, alongside each other. They probably were close. We don't have a lot of surviving documentation, as I say, for the interiority of the marriage. But given what we do know, they were close and they seem to have had a very good working relationship. And at this point, when you have an arranged marriage, that's really the best you can hope for.
Yeah,
sometimes.
Absolutely. Were they roughly around the same age as well? Because sometimes there are some horrendous disparities in ages.
Were roughly of the same age. We know that Thomas Boleyn was born in 1477 and Elizabeth Boleyn, we can assume, was born in 1480. So, you know, you're pretty lucky there with
good.
Being roughly the same age. Yeah. When you think about some of the marriages, you know, Margaret Beaufort, the mother of Henry VII, gave birth to Henry VII at a very young age. That was unusual, though. I think perhaps we overplay the idea of these marriages where a very old man marries a very young woman. Even if you were married as a woman at a very young age, the expectation was that you wouldn't start bearing children until you were physically old enough to do so because of fear of damage and danger to a young girl. So the idea of, like, you know, these dreadful marriages, they did occur, but perhaps have been overplayed in popular imagination.
I mean, Richard II married somebody who's, what, like, literally sort of 30 years younger. She's a child, but she's brought up.
She was seven.
Yeah, but she's got wards who look after her until, you know, she is. Here's the thing. Our perception of Henry VIII, because we know what happens, and this is the problem with a lot of history, because we know how it pans out, you know, and therefore we think of Henry VIII, if you think of him at all, as Henry VIII at the end, this horrendous figure, you know, who is basically gout-ridden and horrendously fat, and, you know, he is dismissing, worse, his wives and falling out with the Pope. When Henry VIII comes to the throne, he is a tremendously athletic. It's like the captain of England rugby becoming... I mean, it's like everybody loves him, he's jousting, he is the most virile man in England, and therefore we don't know how it pans out. So it must have been incredibly exciting to be in that court at that time.
I think so, yeah. The death of Henry VII, Henry VIII's father, and we often miss Henry VII out, right? Everyone likes to imagine that the Tudor reign begins with Henry VIII, but his father, Henry VII, is the founder of the Tudor dynasty with his wife Elizabeth of York, Henry VIII's parents. And by Henry VII's death, he has really gone through it. He's lost his wife, Elizabeth of York, and his son, Arthur Tudor, who is Henry VIII's older brother, who was supposed to be the King of England, but he dies tragically very young. And so Henry VIII marries Catherine of Aragon, who was engaged to marry Arthur Tudor. So when Henry VIII comes to the throne, it is seen as this golden age, this new chapter in English history. Everyone is praising how wonderful this new king is going to be, how virile, how young, how handsome he is, how athletic. And that is why I believe we retell the story of Henry VIII and this tragic downfall and demise. He turned into a tyrant by the end of his reign, but you're right. We tell the story backwards. At the time, the beginning of the reign of Henry VIII, where Elizabeth Boleyn was at court, her first court appearance is 1509, the coronation of Henry VIII, Catherine of Aragon together. That was seen as a golden age for England and a new start, because by the end, Henry VII had turned into the miser that we think of him today, very financially kind of wily, broken individual by the death of his wife and son.
But the problem with Henry VII, and here we go again, we don't like usurpers. Henry IV has the same problem. If you come and you take the crown by force, you are seen as a usurper. So therefore, your son, Henry V, for example, or Henry VIII, is then seen as the rightful heir, and we can erase that past. Because we've only got 11 minutes, and I could talk about this literally until Wednesday, as you can probably tell. But so they're both working in the court. The marriage between Henry and Catherine of Aragon goes on and on and on, but it doesn't produce the most important thing that you need to keep your line going, which is an heir. Does Elizabeth start to think, you know, I could do something here. We could get involved here. I mean, is that Machiavellian, Sophie?
I think that it's very hard to read Elizabeth's motivations at this point. We know that Henry VIII, gets interested in Anne Boleyn around 1526, and he starts to seemingly make a move on her. We know that he writes a series of love letters, very romantic, very dramatic love letters, which still survive in the Vatican archives. He sends those to Anne, and we don't have her responses. And so into that silence over centuries has been read the question of what was Anne Boleyn's motivation. Did she want to be Queen of England? Did she suggest it first? Did Henry suggest it first? A part of that story that we have left out when we think about Henry VIII sending the love letters to Anne Boleyn at Hever, where she was living at the time, the family home. Elizabeth Boleyn was present in Hever for the receipt of those letters. In dramatizations of the story of Anne Boleyn, we imagine her receiving those letters, and we have left her mother out of that story completely, but she was there with her. It's possible, entirely possible, that Elizabeth Boleyn was helping her daughter craft her responses to the king, or was helping her read the letters. They were talking about it. She would have been involved in the great matter. Whether Anne Boleyn wanted to become queen or whether she manipulated the king, all of those, was she a home wrecker? That is the debate that goes on. But I think that the important thing and the purpose of my book is to put Elizabeth Boleyn back in that story and to imagine that while Anne was going through this period of the king was pursuing her, her mother was there offering her advice. And Henry VIII mentions her in one of his love letters. He says at one point, something along the lines of, you will not come to court with your mother or in any other capacity. So already the idea of Anne Boleyn being chaperoned by her mother during this courtship has been raised at the love letters. So it is fascinating to imagine her involvement there.
Because what we've done here is that we put that 20th century look at letters, because a letter from the King of England to is going to go by your mother and be read, because this is strategic. And it's not a case of, oh, young love striking, because, you know, Elizabeth will know darn well that this is going to be taxed strategically very important. If the King of England is showing an interest in your daughter, of course it's going to be great for you, hopefully in the long run, but you have to play it very, very carefully. Because if she hadn't been reading those letters and Anne rejected them, then everybody's out of court. And the next thing you know, you are banished, or you are the very best. So I think it's highly unlikely that Elizabeth isn't. In fact, the whole Boleyn family, it's not sort of a quiet girl going, oh, hi Henry, I'll meet you behind the bike sheds at 5. It's not like that, because the stakes are so high, Sophie.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that all of the Boleyns were playing a role in that period when Henry VIII was pursuing Anne Boleyn. We know, because Henry tells us in the love letters that survive, that George Boleyn, Anne's brother, who's later executed alongside her, was the courier of a lot of those letters. And Henry tells us this. He says at one point, you know, I wish that you were here instead of your brother. So we know that George is carrying these letters between Anne and Henry, and Elizabeth is at Hever, and then Thomas Boleyn is still at court, and they are sort of pursuing an attack on all sides, if you like, to try and help Anne. What do we do about this situation? And perhaps how do we manoeuvre her into a position of power? Is that necessarily what we want? I think that the idea that Thomas Boleyn has been quite vilified over the centuries as this villain of Anne's life, who pushed her into Henry VIII's bed, and her sister before. We know that Mary Boleyn, Anne's sister, had an affair with Henry VIII prior to Anne's involvement. So that's also another question as well. What was that affair? We don't know very much about it, with very little surviving sources. It is just fascinating to imagine how this family dealt with an unprecedented situation.
We know how it all pans out in terms of the Boleyns, okay, because we all know that. But again, nobody looks at the devastating effects it has. I mean, the Boleyns, they're executed. So what, I mean, Elizabeth isn't executed, but imagine the absolute devastating, I mean that in the original context of the word, effect it must have on her. And heartbroken doesn't come into it, but how do the Boleyns even function after those executions?
I think that's a really good question. And we have very little surviving evidence for their lives after the deaths of their children. Obviously, one of the most famous events in English history, Anne Boleyn is executed. She's accused of adultery with several men, one of whom is her brother, George Boleyn. And the idea in the Tudor court at the time was no smoke without a fire. So Anne and George are executed, Anne with a French swordsman, George with an axe. And then Thomas and Elizabeth seem to retreat to Hever, which was, as I say, the family home. And when I was writing that portion of the book and doing that research, because they disappear off the map, Thomas Boleyn continues to go to court because he had to. It was his job. Elizabeth doesn't seem to have returned. She seems to have spent the rest of her days as a relative recluse in Hever Castle, mourning the deaths of her children. I think that it's very human to imagine that time, because Hever was a family home. And if anyone has been, if any of the listeners, it's a very small building. And it's relatively unchanged from the time that the Boleyn family lived there. And so they would have been surrounded by physical reminders of their children, things that haven't survived to this day. You imagine childhood embroidery, portraits, possibly clothes. In the Tudor period, it was very common to turn a textile that was old into something new. And so Thomas and Elizabeth would have been surrounded by the reminders of their children at their home. They would have had the kind of memories that, you know, leave no evidence in the record of this childhood, of this life spent at Hever Castle. I think that it is very tragic to imagine how they coped after the death of their children. There was no court to whom they could appeal. They would have understood this to be the will of God, which I think is an unimaginable and devastating, as you say, devastating loss.
How do you get primary? How do you get your sources? Because again, it's very difficult when you write history, not just because we know what happens, but to make it compelling, you have to write as if you don't. So there are areas that we can't find. So how did you get hold of primary sources for this, Sophie?
There are a lot of surviving primary sources in the National Archives. There's a lot of digitized items as well. The British Library has a lot of wonderful surviving sources. Because Elizabeth Boleyn had a very long court career, you can look at very dry court documents, lists of who was a member of the household, that sort of thing. To fill in the gaps and to bring it to life, we have a wonderful selection of chronicles that survive that tell us, you know, what was going on day to day from eyewitnesses. You've got ambassadors' dispatches, letters from foreign ambassadors whose, like today, job it was to be in the country reporting back to their masters at home about what was going on. So you use all of those documents to kind of give you a broad overview of what's going on in history. And then where you've got the gaps, or where you've got a figure like Elizabeth Boleyn, where the sources haven't survived, that is how you use educated speculation and use your imagination to try and bring these people from the past back to life. And to try and tell the story in an emotive way, because people wonder, you know, why do you care about history? It happened 500 years ago. But these people, they lived and they had these fascinating, incredible lives. And it is about bringing them back to life and trying to find out what survives from these people. How can we try and recover these stories? It's wonderful.
Exactly. History is not about dusty books, people. And you hear me going about this all the time, but it lives. And, you know, absolutely. The book is called Elizabeth Boleyn, The Life of the Queen's Mother. Listeners, you can go to our virtual bookstore and click on the front cover and it'll be winging its way to you. Sophie, if people want to find you online, do you have a website? Do you have socials? Where can people find you?
Yes, you can find me on Blue Sky, Sophie B. Waterman, and also on Instagram at Sophie B. Waterman.
The book is called Elizabeth Boleyn, The Life of the Queen's Mother. It's by Sophie Bacchus Waterman. Sophie, as you can probably tell, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US Soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.